Welcome to Nuclear Matters at CIL, a series of podcasts brought to you by the Nuclear Law and Policy Team at the Center for International Law, or CIL. For more information on the center and this focus area, you may wish to listen to our introductory episode on Introduction to Nuclear Law and Policy, a new focus for CIL. Today's podcast is the first in a series of four episodes that will cover the fundamentals of the three S's, nuclear safety, security, and safeguards, and their interrelationships. I am Nivedita. Together with Denise Cheung, we will be joined in conversation by our special guest, Dr. Charles Ferguson. Dr. Ferguson will kick off the series with a backgrounder, which will explain key concepts relevant to the understanding of the three S's. Dr. Charles D. Ferguson is the director of the Nuclear and Radiation Studies Board in the Division on Earth and Life Studies at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine based in Washington, D.C. He served as the president of the Federation of American Scientists for several years and was a senior fellow for science and technology at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he specialized on nuclear issues. He is the author of Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know, and the co-author of The Four Phases of Nuclear Terrorism. Given his background, Dr. Ferguson's scientific perspective on this area will provide a technical base for legal and policy discussions that will follow as part of this podcast series.
Dr. Charles Ferguson, a very warm welcome to Nuclear Matters at CIL. Before we turn to the topic of nuclear safety, I would like to start with a few background questions, if I may. Starting right at the very beginning with the terms nuclear energy and nuclear power. These terms, Dr. Ferguson, are very often used interchangeably, but they're interrelated, although distinct concepts. I wonder if you could share your thoughts, please, on the distinction between these two terms.
Thank you, Denise, for having me on this inaugural podcast. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to our conversation. Yes, energy and power in general are used interchangeably in everyday speech. But speaking as a physicist and someone trained as a nuclear engineer, they're very precise terms. And you could think of energy as the ability to do work. And work could be something like moving an object, pushing, pulling, or it could be, something of even on your body. If you think about chemical energy, biochemical energy, moving things within your cells and proteins, et cetera, at that level. Or you think about nuclear energy, it could be that you have the fission, the splitting of a heavy nucleus of a uranium atom or a plutonium atom, and that releases a lot of energy compared to the size of that atom. And so that energy can then be used to do all sorts of work. It could heat up water to make steam, and then that steam can be used to do the work of turning a turbine that is then linked to an electrical generator. And so then you can create electrical work. So all along the chain, there's a transformation process going on, change after change after change, going from the level of the very tiny nucleus of a uranium atom splitting into and releasing that nuclear energy that gets translated or transformed into heat. And then that heat can then be used to do useful things like create electrical energy. And then that leads to the concept of power. So often when people talk about nuclear power, I think in their minds, they're thinking of electrical power, because typically that's what nuclear energy or nuclear power has been used for in the world, and all the nuclear power plants around the world see that use power. And so when we think about nuclear power, typically we're thinking about electrical power, and power is the rate of change of energy. So it's energy per unit time. So, you know, how fast is that energy changing or how slowly is it changing? You know, but it's the rate of change. So you have the dimension of time when you think about power and being able to do something useful like run the computers we're using right now to do this interview and to turn on, you know, electrical lights and all sorts of other electrical applications around the world is what electrical power is very good for. And nuclear power is just one way of being able to create electrical power. And, it, you know, often it just comes down to just heating up some kind of fluid. And typically it's water that is used to cool a nuclear plant, but also the working fluid that's used to make steam that turns a turbine that goes very, very fast. And a bundle of wires are nearby, wrapped very tightly in an electrical generator. And those electrical wires moving very, very rapidly will create that electromagnetic force that can then be directed into power lines to go out and provide electrical power to homes and businesses in cities around the world, or you know, anywhere around the world, even the countryside. There are now plans to try to distribute nuclear power even away from the major cities, and yeah, that's something perhaps we could talk about later in the interview.
Thank you very much for that, Charles. I think certainly in this part of the world, when people use the term nuclear power, it is, as you say, it's with this understanding that it relates to harnessing nuclear energy in a nuclear power plant to produce electrical energy. But as I listen to your definitions and your explanations, nuclear power in the context of a nuclear-powered submarine would be to use the energy for propulsion purposes, right? So the work in that sense would be to propel the submarine. In that context, but certainly in Southeast Asia, when we talk about nuclear power, it's in the context of, oftentimes it's in the context of electrical energy, the conversion from nuclear energy to electrical energy. Thank you for that.
And there are other applications too. Yes, thank you for mentioning the application of propulsion for submarines. So it could be propulsion for aircraft carriers, or even civilian ships. There have been some applications decades ago where some commercial ships were powered by nuclear energy, and the power there was turning that propulsion shaft with a propeller in the water that would propel that ship through the water. But there are other types of applications to nuclear energy other than leading to electrical power or propulsion power. For example, one could use nuclear energy to make medical isotopes for nuclear medicine. And so for things like diagnostic purposes to figure out what ailments people have, and it can allow allow a doctor to look at things like your lungs and heart and other organs with use of these medical isotopes. One could also use nuclear energy to make what's called process heat, industrial heat, that can be used for various industrial purposes that require a lot of heat. And so these are some applications that are being explored further in order to develop additional markets for the use of nuclear energy, not just using nuclear energy to make power, electrical power.
Charles, it's great that you mentioned the other applications, because one concept that keeps coming up when you think about nuclear is radiation and ionizing radiation. So what is ionizing radiation, and why is that such a big concern?
Well, ionizing radiation, it comes down to the ability for some energy source to knock electrons off of atoms and create ions. So an ion is just some type of charged particle, typically an atom that has one or more electrons that are knocked off of it. And that results in some net positive charge. So some very basic physics here. So, you know, we have things called protons, which are in the nucleus, nuclei of atoms. And those protons have a positive charge, each proton positive one. And around the nucleus are electrons. Each electron has a negative one charge. A neutral atom has an equal number of protons and electrons. They balance each other out electrically. So now imagine that there's an X-ray that's emitted by some radioactive substance. And that X-ray, you know, smacks into an atom and hits an electron and knocks it out of the atom's orbit. And so the net result is you have this now a plus one charge in that ion. And that's, you know, then could lead to potential damage if it's inside your cells. So if there's enough ionization, enough atoms that are have their electrons knocked off, creating a lot of ions, and that could lead to cell damage in a body. And typically, the body can repair that if it's very low dose, low dose radiation. The body has mechanisms to repair that types of damage. You know, we're kind of seeing that now with how, you know, COVID-19 is playing out. You know, that we have this immune system that's a wonderful system that typically can repair damage and people, you know, can recover. But there are cases where if there's a severe dose, if there's a severe amount of ionizing radiation, the damage is so extensive that the body might not be able to repair it. And that could then potentially lead to cancer. Or in the case where there's so much ionizing radiation, it could lead to more immediate health effects, nausea, vomiting, hair loss, bleeding. And fortunately, we have really not seen many, many cases of that in the world. There have been some cases, such as the Chernobyl accident, where the emergency workers who were trying to fight the fires, for example, did suffer severe doses of ionizing radiation and came down with radiation sickness and died from that. Very rarely do people recover from severe doses. But typically, when we go about our daily business, we're exposed to ionizing radiation. So I think that's an important thing people understand, that there's no escaping ionizing radiation. And that's fine. You know, humanity and other life forms have been thriving in this environment. And perhaps it's actually, you know, a positive thing. And that's a bit of a, you know, controversial statement. It divides people, whether very low dose ionizing radiation are good for you or harmful, or maybe they as a wash and it just kind of like your neutral effects over time. But the point being is that we're exposed to sources of ionizing radiation from the sun and from the universe, called cosmic rays, from radiation in the earth, from radioactive decay and material, you know, earth materials, rocks, from uranium in rocks, et cetera, and from dental x-rays and from other medical x-rays. And, you know, things like x-rays for dental and medical purposes or for beneficial purposes. So it's a trade-off. So for some very low dose ionizing radiation, we can still get beneficial medical health effects from that. So I don't want to leave people thinking that I have to live in a zero ionizing radiation environment. It's not going to happen. And you don't need to worry about it because there's no escaping it. And it's actually, that's not going to kill you. There are far other environmental hazards that we need to worry about much more than very low dose ionizing radiation.
Thank you very much for clarifying that. I'm sure a lot of people will feel more consoled with that explanation. So speaking of nuclear power and energy, I was wondering if you could provide a brief explanation as to what the nuclear fuel cycle is?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, it's a very interesting a system and multiple steps. So I'll try to be relatively brief and not go into anyone in incredible depth. But, you know, it all begins with what we have on Earth. And, you know, we have, you know, limited supplies of various minerals. And where do those come from? Well, they came from stars originally, you know, stars that exploded billions of years ago and that created these very heavy elements, uranium in particular. And uranium comes in different types of forms called isotopes, depending on the number of neutrons in the nucleus. And so we go back to something like 4.5 billion years ago when the Earth was formed in this giant kind of interplanetary cloud. When that Earth coalesced, it now in the Earth's crust and other parts of the planet Earth are minerals and ore bodies that contain uranium and things like thorium, things that can be made to fission and release, you know, nuclear energy. And so we have some finite supply of that uranium that was created. And so we can go and find places in the Earth where there are ores or mineral bodies that have relatively high concentrations of uranium. And I say relatively, I'm not talking about, you know, you just go somewhere and you just find this big giant lump of uranium. It doesn't work that way. It's more distributed. We're talking about if you have, you know, one part in 1,000 of uranium in an ore body, that's very good. And that's usually worthwhile to mine and extract that uranium. So it all begins with the mining step. You know, extracting uranium from mining, and there are different mining techniques that can be used depending on the ore body. And then the next step is to kind of refine that rocky material, that ore body material, to further extract out that uranium in a milling process. And the result of the milling process is a material that's often called yellowcake. Although nowadays, depending on the process, it doesn't necessarily have a yellowish color, but traditionally it did. And that yellow cake is some combination of uranium combined with oxygen. So some type of uranium oxide type compound. Typical chemical formula is 3 uranium atoms chemically connected to about 8 oxygen atoms, a U3O8 type of chemical typically, but it could vary. And so the next step after that milling is to take that quote unquote yellow cake material and then do some chemistry on it, some chemical conversions to then convert that uranium into a material, a chemical that can be then processed to make nuclear fuel. And so now there's a decision point that opens up. So some types of nuclear reactors can make use of what's called natural uranium, the uranium that we get out of the earth, out of nature. And that uranium has very little, a tiny fraction, actually it's 0.7% of it is what's called uranium-235, which is the type of isotope of uranium that's easy to fission. And that's the most desirable type of uranium for a nuclear reactor. So there are, you know, Canada in particular has a lot of these types of reactors, sometimes called CANDU reactors, CANDU, for Canadian deuterium uranium reactors. And South Korea has a few. India has several. But most countries in the world have a type of reactor that requires boosting the concentration of uranium-235. And that boosting process is called enrichment, i.e. kind of enriching or increasing the concentration of uranium-235 compared to the more prevalent uranium isotope, uranium-238. And so that enrichment process requires doing a lot of work. And it requires specialized type of enrichment plant and specialized types of equipment. And there are different techniques one can use, but now in the world, only one technique is being used, and that's the centrifuge technique, where you're spinning a rotor, a cylinder, very, very rapidly, and you inject uranium gas into that centrifuge. And the gas is made up of uranium tetrafluoride. And to get to that stage, you go back to the stuff from the milling process, and you have to do some chemical steps on it to then combine that uranium with fluorine. And then you can take that uranium fluorine chemical and then create a gas from that and inject it into this enrichment process. And over many, many steps of enrichment, what comes out at the end is some enriched material, typically 3 to 5% uranium-235. So you went from 0.7% uranium-235, and then you end up with something on order of 3% to 5%, typically, depending on the type of reactor and its enrichment requirements. And so that's a very intensive, work-intensive process. And very few countries in the world have the ability to do enrichment or have enrichment plants because they're expensive. But and those that have invested in that, you know, decades ago, now, you know, pretty much have a lock on the market. You know, countries like Russia. Russia has many, many centrifuge plants. In Europe, you have a consortium called Urenco. It involves the Netherlands, Germany, and Great Britain. And Urenco now has an enrichment plant in the United States, in the state of New Mexico. The United States actually shut down its enrichment plants because they were too expensive. And now the United States is in the process of trying to develop its own type of enrichment technology. And Japan has a small enrichment plant. China has an enrichment plant, but it's not that large. And Iran is also trying to develop enrichment as well. And they have a relatively small plant that is causing, you know, some concern internationally. But by and large, the enrichment market is relatively small because of the high cost to develop enrichment plants. And once, you know, the players have entered the market, then they can have, you know, market dominance on enrichment. Once that enriched material is produced, then you have to do a reverse chemical process. You have to then convert that uranium fluorine chemical into a chemical that can then be made into a uranium fuel material. And so typically what's done is to do chemistry on it to create uranium dioxide, uranium combined with two oxygen atoms. And then that can then be formed into these fuel pellets, which are, you know, typically no more than less than a centimeter in height, typically, or maybe half a centimeter, or actually maybe a quarter of a centimeter, but think about it. And you can stack up these fuel pellets into these long fuel rods, long meaning, you know, a couple of meters typically, and or maybe higher, depending on the type of reactor we're talking about. And then those fuel rods are bundled together into what's called fuel assemblies. So you have many, many rods. You have dozens of these fuel rods bundled together into a fuel assembly. And then you could have multiple fuel assemblies going into a nuclear reactor. And so the bottom line is that there's a lot of uranium that gets it put into a nuclear reactor at the beginning of the nuclear fueling process. And that's because to create, you know, 1,000 megawatts of electrical power, which is a huge amount of power, enough to power a typical city of about 1 million people, you need a lot of uranium to start with, even though nuclear energy is very concentrated type of energy. And so the reactor's fueled. The fuel typically stays in there, you know, a year, 2 years, maybe even longer, depending on the fuel type. A lot of the nuclear power industry is trying to extend the life of nuclear fuel to limit the amount of shutdown time when the reactor is taken offline and the fuel is removed. And that removed fuel is highly radioactive, very hot, and that is then placed in the pool of water. And it's typically placed in a pool of water for about 5 years so it can cool down enough that then either dispose of it into some kind of geological disposal site, or you can recycle the nuclear material. And a few countries around the world are doing the recycling process that will involve some chemistry called reprocessing to extract out the uranium and the plutonium that's been produced, and then recycle that into new fuel that can be placed into reactors again. And the reprocessing process has been controversial because it's very expensive, and it could also be prone to create weapons material, plutonium, that could potentially be used in nuclear weapons. So that's something perhaps we can get into later in terms of the proliferation risk, those types of security risk. But it's a lot to cover in terms of the nuclear fuel cycle. See, there's multiple steps, and I was trying to limit myself not to go into particular depth in any particular one, but it's really a very global industry, and not any one particular country has a lock on the market. And it's a very interdependent global system in terms of the manufacturers of the fuel, the manufacturers of the reactors, the manufacturers of these chemical plants, and also those around the world who are doing the mining process.
Thank you very much, Charles. This brings us to the end of today's discussion on The Backgrounder. Thank you for listening to episode 1 of Nuclear Matters at CIL. Do look out for episode 2, where we will continue our conversation with Dr. Charles Ferguson on the fundamentals of nuclear safety. Have a good day.